for Thursday, June 29, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Supreme Court rejects the use of military tribunals to try Guantanamo Bay detainees.
The military commissions, and I think this is what the court recognized, were essentially a fake court.
And Congress inches closer to approving the historic India-U.S. nuclear deal. We'll hear what that could mean in New Delhi.
It's part of a strategic deal because in the Indo-U.S. Defense Framework Agreement, they have also agreed to collaborate in multilateral operations without the term UN being anywhere in the document.
Those stories, plus a preview of this weekend's presidential elections in Mexico. But first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A series of attacks has left at least 12 people dead in Iraq today. This just one day after the Associated Press reported that 11 Sunni insurgent groups have announced they are prepared to enact an immediate ceasefire if the U.S. agrees to withdraw from Iraq within 2 years. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has decided to send a delegation to the southern Sudanese city of Juba for possible peace talks with LRA rebels. Emmanuel Okela reports from Kampala, Uganda.
President Museveni has appointed a team of negotiators to meet with southern Sudanese President Salva Kiir to explore the possibilities of talking to LRA rebel leader Joseph Kony. Internal Affairs Minister Ruhakana Rugunda, who will lead the negotiating team, told Free Speech Radio News that the delegation will hold preliminary talks with President Salva Kiir, and any prospects of talking directly to the LRA delegation will depend on results of these consultations.
Many people, including myself, are skeptical, but whenever there is an opportunity, a chance for a peaceful solution, in spite of skepticism, we should always grab it. So Uganda government has always kept its doors open for a possible peaceful solution to the conflict and the suffering of the people in northern Uganda.
The preliminary consultations will include the issue of the composition of the LRA delegation and the southern Sudanese government's conditions for mediating the talks. President Museveni has also said that his government is ready to talk to a credible and genuine LRA delegation, which must not include Joseph Kony and his four commanders wanted for war crimes. The new government of southern Sudan has offered to facilitate peace talks between the LRA and the Uganda government. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The Chilean government has introduced changes to the country's anti-terrorism law. The law, which passed during the Augusto Pinochet dictatorship, has been used in the past few years against Mapuche Indians who are fighting to reclaim their lands. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
The government introduced reforms to the anti-terrorist legislation that looks at changing what is considered a terrorist act and what is not, and to alter the penalties accordingly. The legislation seeks to strike from the books certain actions like arson and keep only those that threaten life, physical well-being, freedom, and public health. Mapuche Indians in southern Chile have staged different actions in efforts to recuperate lands taken over by the forestry industry. Mapuches have been convicted of setting fire to logging camps, farmhouses, and wood stands. Four Mapuche Indians began serving in 2004 a 10-year jail sentence convicted of arson under the Anti-Terrorist Act. The four staged a lengthy hunger strike demanding their release. Two senators introduced legislation in April that would free the Mapuches, but the legislation has been bogged down because it is tailored to meet the demands of the four Mapuches. In response, the government tabled reforms to the Anti-Terrorism Act. Included in the reforms is striking arson from the law. Opposition senators say they will oppose any changes that eliminate arson from the Anti-Terrorist Act, but pro-government senators say the changes are needed. If the government changes are approved, the Mapuches would be free in a short period of time, because arson is a criminal offense that carries a 3-year maximum sentence. Meanwhile, an international human rights organization is investigating the well-being of the four Mapuches and monitor changes to the Anti-Terrorist Act. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
A citizens' movement to remove the governor of the Mexican state of Oaxaca continues to gain momentum ahead of the presidential elections. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
Last night, more than 500,000 people marched over 7 miles through Oaxaca City calling for the resignation of the governor and his cabinet. Earlier this week, a delegation of public school teachers from Oaxaca traveled to Mexico City to deliver a petition containing what they say was close to 1 million signatures to the nation's Congress. The petition called on Congress to dissolve the government in Oaxaca and clear the path for an interim state government. The Senate has the power to declare a state government illegitimate in extreme cases of political instability. Meanwhile, organizations and citizens opposed to the state government have formed their own decision-making body called the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, known as APO by its initials in Spanish. As presidential elections near, many of the most influential organizations involved in the Oaxacan mobilizations are calling for the electorate to vote against the PRI party, which has ruled the state without interruption for over 75 years. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
More than 200,000 people have had to evacuate parts of Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Maryland due to severe flooding. At least 10 people have died from the rains and flooding in the Northeast. At airtime, residents of Pennsylvania's Wilkes-Barre area were receiving notice that it is now safe to return home. A severe thunderstorm warning remains in effect for parts of Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In a blow to the Bush administration, the Supreme Court rejected the use of military tribunals to try Guantanamo Bay detainee Salim Ahmed Hamdan. The victors in the case say the decision is an essential use of checks and balances, while the dissenters say the court is overstepping the president's war powers. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
In Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, the court ruled 5-3 that military tribunals to try detainees are illegal. The decision will have no impact on the existence of Guantanamo Bay, the military detention center holding about 450 detainees, but it does mean that detainees charged with crimes will be tried with the same rights as an American citizen. Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift of the Navy, one of Hamdan's defense attorneys.
All we have wanted is a fair trial, and we thank the Supreme Court for ensuring that Mr. Hamdan will get one.
Salim Ahmed Hamdan is known as Osama bin Laden's former driver and Guantanamo Bay detainee. He contested that he should be tried in a civilian court rather than a military tribunal set up by the president. The majority opinion, written by Justice John Paul Stevens, said that the rules specified for Hamdan's military trial were illegal. Hamdan would have had to forfeit many of his rights, including the right to be present at his trial. Stevens wrote the military tribunal created to try Hamdan did not adhere to the Geneva Convention of 1949 and that Congress never authorized the tribunal. The dissenting opinion, written by Justice Scalia, supports presidential power. The opinion said the court overstepped its authority in an issue they have no expertise, and that issue is war. Richard Samp, one attorney for the government, reiterated that opinion.
The decision today is a travesty in terms of the way that the court has decided to establish itself as a super military authority and to second guess the views not only of the executive branch but also of Congress.
The dissenting opinion also said the case will open the courts to a flood of Gitmo detainee cases. Justice Clarence Thomas read a second dissenting opinion. He has never read a dissent in his 15 years on the court, but felt this decision was too unfortunate not to do so. Two current options for trials do exist, the federal court system or court martials. Court martials are used for U.S. military personnel and criminals of war and assures constitutional rights of the alleged. But the president would like to keep the military tribunals open.
We will conform to the Supreme Court. We will analyze the decision. To the extent that the Congress is given any latitude to develop a way forward using military tribunals, we will work with them.
Richard Samp, attorney for the government, says new legislation to legalize the military tribunals is a possible solution.
It is a relatively narrow procedural decision which allows the government to go forward with military tribunals if it wants to slightly amend its rules.
Neil Katia, an attorney for Hamdan, interpreted that option as undesirable.
it is up to Congress, of course. But what I think the court said today is that our fundamental values are at stake. And I think issued a cautionary note to those who would rush in and legislate, just as President Bush rushed in to create these military commissions.
Civil rights groups praised the court's decision. Meanwhile, activists outside the courthouse protested the detention center. Art Laffin is with the Catholic group Dorothy Day.
And unfortunately, it's 4 years too late, and so many people have suffered horrific experiences undergoing torture and other mistreatment at Guantanamo. And then there have been three suicides there. And this would be cause enough to say that this place should be closed down.
Chief Justice John Roberts abstained from today's ruling. He was part of the lower court decision which upheld military tribunals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
The Israeli army carried out a number of large-scale invasions and arrests throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem last night. At least 87 Palestinians were arrested, most of them Hamas-affiliated legislators and government officials. The Palestinian government declared the arrests an open act of war, and an Israeli settler abducted Monday was found dead in Ramallah this morning. Saeed Banoura reports from Beit Sahur, Palestine.
Among the Palestinian officials arrested in the latest Israeli raid was the leader of the Legislative Council, as well as ministers, mayors, bureaucrats, and council members. Al-Mutawakkil Taha, the Palestinian Deputy Minister of Information.
These are not merely arrests. They are extrajudicial abductions carried out by the occupation forces to destroy the Palestinian political regime and to create a vacuum state. We condemn all of these illegal procedures. We totally reject all of the excuses and justifications by the occupation forces to arrest these people who were legitimately elected. They know that these people have nothing to do with any military action. It came under the pretext that no Palestinian is immune, which means that every Palestinian is targeted.
Tayyip Abdul Rahim is advisor to the Palestinian president.
This policy is an attempt to destroy the Palestinian political system in order to avoid dealing with the Palestinian partner for peace. We ask the Israeli government and the international community to release the Palestinian legislators and mayors.
The Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz reported that the list of arrestees was approved weeks ago by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Early Thursday morning, the Israeli army found the body of an Israeli settler abducted on Monday after an arrested Palestinian fighter revealed the location of the body during interrogation. The Nasser Salah al-Din Brigade's armed wing of the Palestinian Popular Resistance Committees, PRC, claimed they killed the settler. The brigades had threatened on Tuesday that they would kill the captive settler if Israeli attacks continued. Israeli and international actors are warning Israel that escalating military attacks will result in the death of the soldier they are purportedly attempting to rescue. Uri Avniri, former Israeli parliament member.
If the Israeli army believes that it has reliable information and that it has a plan to rescue the man alive, they could try it, but it's a kind of roulette playing with the life of people, and I hope this will not happen again. I'm afraid of a military escalation on both sides in which many people will die on both sides and a lot of damage will be done on both sides, and I do hope very much that this can be avoided.
Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz held a meeting with his military officials Thursday afternoon in which he approved further steps of the military operation Summer Rain in Gaza. Today afternoon, Israeli warplanes airdropped leaflets on southern Gaza calling on Palestinians to avoid fighting against Israeli security forces, not to wander around in areas in which the army was operating, and to comply with army instruction for the sake of their own safety. Similar flyers were scattered over northern Gaza Wednesday, warning residents that the army will invade the area soon and threatened a large-scale military assault. Raji Sorani with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza.
We were suffering from a state of real social-economical suffocation. Now, adding to that, all these military attacks, I mean by air, by sea, and by air terror, on very daily basis where Gaza is shelled by 100 to 300 shells every day. It's a real hard and tough situation. It's, I can say, unprecedented one. I mean, anywhere in Gaza you can sit and you will hear either direct or indirect sound of these artillery shells.
Palestinian political analysts have challenged the timing of this Israeli escalation, which came just after a Palestinian National Unity government was agreed to on Monday after months of negotiations. This is Saed Banoura reporting from imemc.org for Free Speech Radio News in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
The U.S. Congress has taken its first stride towards endorsing the India-U.S. nuclear deal. In what's seen as a prelude to a congressional yes for the landmark nuclear agreement, the House of Representatives International Relations Committee squashed half a dozen amendments that were designed to be deal breakers, and the legislation is now slated for the full House. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee completed its version of the deal today. The historic deal helps India end its international nuclear isolation and helps U.S. commercial interests find a huge market in India. Vinod Kajos reports from New Delhi.
Congress has got to understand that it's in our economic interests that India have a civilian nuclear power industry to help take the pressure off of the global demand for energy.
That was George Bush 3 months ago in New Delhi. He assured Indians nuclear energy. Now the path is clear for the controversial nuclear deal. India, the fastest growing market after China, has huge energy requirements. Retired Army officer Uday Bhaskar is with the Indo-US Joint Task Force.
India's interest really is to be able to obtain the kind of cooperation and interaction with the global nuclear community, so that its existing power reactors for civilian use could be sustained for the long term. At the moment, one of the elements which is critical for India is the supply of fuel, the so-called yellow cake or the uranium ore. Now, the last supply to India was made by Russia, which was a one-time supply, which was for our reactor in Tarapur.
India has a nuclear past. It first tested nuclear weapons 30 years ago. Russians gave them the uranium. Again in 1998, it tested nuclear. This time, the United States was quick to impose sanctions on India. These sanctions were lifted when the Bush administration came to power. Now the cooperation between both the countries has reached into a higher level. US amended its nuclear rules just for India. Professor Kamal Mitra Chennoi is with the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament and Peace in New Delhi. He believes there are larger plans for the US in giving India nuclear energy.
The nuclear establishment is pushing nuclear energy because nuclear energy is dual use. Whereas on the other hand, posing of the problem as just a nuclear deal is actually a misnomer. It's part of a strategic deal because in the Indo-US Defense Framework Agreement, they have also agreed to collaborate in multilateral operations without the term UN being anywhere in the document. So that could include anything from Iraq to Afghanistan.
The bill, now renamed US and India Nuclear Cooperation Promotion Act 2006, is not yet through. There is a long way to go before the agreement can actually be implemented. Michael Levy, Council on Foreign Relations.
The big question will be what will happen when the Nuclear Cooperation Agreement comes up. The House International Relations Committee has made it very clear that this is not a final sign-off on the agreement and that several other very important things that are still uncertain need to happen before Congress will be willing to sign off finally on the deal.
Meanwhile, another nuclear power in the South Asian region, Pakistan, reiterated that Indo-US nuclear deal would trigger arms imbalance in the region. Both countries have already fought three wars. Also, India's left parties are critical of the nuclear deal. Communist Party of India, which provide key outside support to the Congress Party-led coalition government, expressed strong reservations over the clauses in the bill and asked the government not to change its foreign policy under American pressure. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod Kajos for FSRN.
The Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee voted 15-7 to approve the Republican legislation on telecommunications today. Public interest groups claim that the language of the legislation is too weak to prevent phone operators from favoring their internet traffic and discriminating against others. Anastasia Gnezditska reports from Washington, D.C.
After a heated bipartisan debate, the Senate Commerce Committee approved the Advanced Telecommunications and Opportunity Reform Act. This bill was called a big win for telecom companies, for it substantially decreases state regulation in key telecom areas. One of those areas, internet neutrality, spurred most intense debate. The bill is supported by those largely Republican senators who want to grant the phone and cable companies the power to choose who gets access to high-speed lanes and whose content gets seen first and fastest. Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican from Maine, went against a party line in proposing amendment to the bill that would strongly protect net neutrality.
This is a broad-based, grassroots effort, and for good reason, because every day as more and more citizens learn about the issue of net neutrality, they realize that the internet as they know it is very much at risk. Net neutrality protects the information superhighway. Telecom companies will have the ability to charge each website a fee for hosting their web pages and turning the information superhighway into a limited toll access road. In this new multi-tiered internet, those who can and are willing to pay will receive first-class treatment while everyone else is stuck in steering.
Snow's amendment that was defeated in the committee would have barred Bell and cable companies from discriminating in their, quote, treatment of internet traffic based on the source, destination, or ownership of such traffic. Commerce Chairman Stevens included his own version of net neutrality that would prohibit Bell companies from blocking websites based on political affiliation. But it would not bar fees to preferred businesses for speedier internet delivery. The key argument of the Republicans supporting the Stevens version was that telecom companies are entitled to charge firms for preferential treatment because they have invested so much in broadband network infrastructure. According to this view, net neutrality stifles investment and innovation in telecom area. Anthony Riddle, executive director of Alliance for Community Media, disagrees.
Cable franchising is a 30 to 40% profit margin. Not only does it have huge gross revenues, like in New York City alone, it's over $1 billion a year gross revenues. 30% of that is profit. There is no way they're not going to invest. Wall Street doesn't want to gamble. If you have strong net neutrality, there's still going to be a lot of money made on the internet, but you don't know who's going to make it because the playing field is a lot more level. But if you can restrict who has access, then you know who's going to make money, and it's going to be the people who own the wires and who own the fibers.
The next step to follow the committee vote will be a full Senate vote, which will most likely happen in September. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Mexican voters head to the polls this Sunday for what may well be the closest presidential election in that country in nearly 200 years. With the two leading candidates only a few percentage points apart and fears of potential fraud, the stakes are high in this weekend's vote. FSRN's Norman Stockwell reports from Mexico City.
Standing beneath the statue of Mexico's most popular president, Benito Juarez, whose bicentennial is being celebrated this year, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO as he is nicknamed, draws his audience along to the obvious parallels. Juarez is celebrated for his opposition to French imperial occupation in the 19th century. AMLO wants to renegotiate the agriculture portions of NAFTA, which has caused over 1.6 million family farms to shut down since 1994. Fears over a potential trade war with Mexico is just one thing that has the U.S. nervous. A recently revealed secret military report states that Mexico is endangering oil production by not allowing enough, quote, foreign investment, a position strongly maintained by the PRD.
There has been this great swing of pendulum in Latin America.
John Ross, longtime political observer and journalist based in Mexico City.
Neoliberalism failed, and Lula got elected, and Kirchner got elected, and Evo got elected, and Chavez got elected, and Tabaré Vázquez got elected. And the next guy to get elected on this in this scenario is López Obrador. He represents what they represent, although, indeed, he may not turn out to represent that at all. But within the U.S. views, that's what he represents, no? And so it's very crucial for the U.S. to win, that López Obrador doesn't win this election, that Calderón wins this election.
A self-described left candidate, López Obrador and his Alliance for the Good of All coalition, made up mostly of the Democratic Left PRD party, is leading by 2 or 3 percentage points in just about every poll. His chief opponent, Felipe Calderón of the National Action Party, or PAN, is fighting hard to retain the government his party only just wrested in 2000 from the hands of the PRI, or Institutional Revolutionary Party, which had held the presidency for over 70 years. Calderón, the successor to current President Vicente Fox, who is barred by the Constitution from seeking a second term, has his strongest support among Mexico's business classes. But with Mexico's shrinking economic growth and the devastating effects of over 10 years of the North American Free Trade Agreement on Mexico's over 25% rural population, Calderón has had a difficult time getting the ear of Mexico's poor and working class. Instead, he has used fear of social unrest and drug traffic to justify the hard hand of the state.
That they put themselves in charge of processing in a specialized way and with the full backing of society, the delinquents and narco-traffickers that are associated with powerful mafias. That they process them, judge them, convict them, and extradite them, so that we can liberate places like Tijuana, like Nuevo Laredo, and like Acapulco of this cancer before it eats away at our society. Zero tolerance.
Roberto Madrazo, candidate for the PRI, has little to offer in terms of new ideas and mostly campaigns on the platform that the other parties have little or no experience in governing the country. Unfortunately, most of Mexico remembers all too well their experience under 7 decades of corrupt rule from his party and is not ready to revisit that recent past. Two other candidates, feminist Patricia Mercado of the Social Democratic Farmer Alternative Party and Roberto Campa of the New Alliance Party, a technocratic, economically conservative formation, create only small blips in the polling numbers. The PRD's López Obrador served as the mayor of Mexico City from 2000 to 2005 and is best known for his anti-poverty campaigns. It is his call for a new social compact that resonates most with the working people in this city.
Yo invito a todos.
I invite everyone so that together we can pull our country forward, so that we can build a new accord, a new social pact, with the objective of moving our country forward and to take our people out of poverty and marginalization. We're going towards change on the road of harmony.
AMLO's campaign closing rally took place last night in the main square, or Zócalo, of Mexico City, where over 200,000 people gathered under banners reading, "Smile, we have already won." López Obrador looked beyond the elections and spoke of acting on his plans as president.
From next Monday on, I'm going to start calling forward representatives from companies, from churches, from civil society, representatives from indigenous and campesinos, professionals, intellectuals, to construct an accord, a new national pact with the main purpose of pushing our country forward, to place Mexico in the place it deserves among nations around the world, and overall, to take our people out of poverty and marginalization.
For Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Mexico City, this is Norman Stockwell.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent newscast produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary online at fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.